Annalene, are they back yet?
Mel wore a special cowl, supplying his tendrilled head with moisture, but he was flushed red nonetheless.
The posse! I heard the call go off.
They heard it on Sir Urja, Doc, Annalene said. And Sir Urjans don't have ears. She didn't know if Mon Calamari had ears either, but she knew Doc Mel wouldn't mind the joke. The call was a gaudy display of decibels. Half the breakables in the store had fallen to the first test of the system years earlier. Annalene had learned to tune it out, a talent perfected during a lifetime in retail.
They still might need a medic. I should meet them on the way back,
the doctor said, before cracking the door and pushing his young son inside. Annalene started.
Hey, wait, don't leave your kid here.
I'll be back.
The door slammed. Annalene pitched the data pad over her shoulder and felt her forehead. Yes, she was still here. And so were the four other younglings that had already been dropped off when their parents left with the posse. Two were at a table eating food plucked from the shelf. Two more were hiding somewhere. Babysitting wasn't her job, but with people rushing out to help someone in need, she'd found it hard to argue. Except people frequently left their children when there was no emergency, too. Annalene looked down on the sniffling pink ragamuffin and rolled her eyes. She sighed.
Oh,
all right. She took the boy by the shoulders and pointed him to a rack near the wall. Take a broom, kid. And nothing else.
Yes, ma'am.
The child began to dutifully sweep the floor near the table where the other children were sitting. From inside the front door, Lily laughed.
Good luck, Annie.
Annalene scowled playfully.
Just go. You're letting the tepid air out.
A low whine sounded from the west, slowly increasing in volume and crescendo. Annalene dashed to the counter to check the video feed from the Southern Hillside security cam. She saw what she expected to see. Land speeders coming back from the Vizard farm. And she also saw what she had feared to see. Jabe, perched precariously on the back of Vika Galt's snazzy landspeeder. Annalene opened the window and called out to her daughter.
Callie, bring me a bantha prod.
The girl looked up from her work.
You want the training prod or the big one?
Dark eyebrows made an angry V. Doesn't matter.
Chapter 4.
For Orin, returning to the claim was always like coming home. It wasn't his home, of course. It was Danar's. And then Danar's and Annalene's. And for the last several years, Annalene's alone. But Orin felt the tie to the compound that went beyond the law, or such law as there was on Tatooine. Orin had laid the first bricks for the store, driven in the first landspeeder for repair, and eaten the first meal at the lunch counter. A place was a thing, and you weren't supposed to get sentimental about things, but it was also his last link to the best friend he'd ever had, and that wasn't something he'd ever be able to ignore. The claim had been Danar's big idea. He was good with ideas, even better than Orin was. Together, they'd made great things happen in the Oasis. One day, they'd imagined, Orin's farms and Danar's market would turn into a second Anchorhead, or even Bastine. Orin could see that happening. The Pika had that much potential. But Danar had changed after marrying his sales clerk. He'd always kept a foot in the store after that, never willing to risk more than he could afford at one time. And after Callie was born, forget it. Fatherhood had the opposite effect on Orin. He couldn't wait to hit the range each day, searching for treasure in the air. But Danar's bets were ever smaller, and on surer things. That had made Danar's claim a strong operation, to be sure. a good earner, even by Orin's current standards. But it had meant that only one of them was able to go for the main chance when opportunity came. By the time Jabe was in the cradle, Orin's holdings had almost completely enveloped the store property. Not that Danar had ever begrudged Orin's success. Danar had been happy to see someone making use of his ideas, and the fact that it was a friend profiting made it even better. The Calwell and Galt operations were as close as they could be without a legal partnership, which the friends never contemplated, given their mutual contempt for the legal clerks in Bastien. No tax collector had any right to either man's work. And if Orin wanted to store his vaporator construction speeders in Danar's garages, or if Danar wanted to arrange his dewbacks on Orin's land, well, they didn't need a document for that. The policy had continued under Annalene, more or less, in the nearly 8 years since Danar passed. The claim's spare garages now held the entire Galt work fleet. And when Orin took administrative control of the settlers' call fund he had co-founded with his neighbors, it made perfect sense that the claim should serve as its operational base. The facility had plenty of room to house the emergency response vehicles owned by the fund. And if the responders needed an arsenal, they only had to walk next door to find Annalene's gun racks. There was one more thing the claim had to offer, Orin knew. The reward for a dangerous job well done. As manager of the call fund, Orin had seen the need and made the provision long ago, and no one had ever argued. His was a vigilante organization with a liquor tab.
Good stuff here, folks.
Orin climbed out of his prized USV-5 landspeeder and slapped the hood. The other vehicles were arriving one by one.
Park the loners by the garage. We'll take care of them. And you can drink your fill before the lunch rush.
A cheer rose from the growing crowd. Some quickly headed into Danner's claim, but more lingered outside, sharing their stories and trophies. Reminded, Orin reached into the landspeeder to find his new gaffy stick, or gadurfi, or whatever the savages call the bizarre hunks of metal. The young Tuscan cut to pieces in the crossfire had carried this one. Now, with one boot on the bobbing hood of his parked hovercraft, Orin hoisted the weapon over his head. He gave a war whoop and smiled broadly. Another cheer went up.
Let's hear it for the King of the Jundland!
Orin's head snapped back at the sound of the feminine voice. Vika was there, having parked her vehicle behind the others. Young Jabe and a couple of other settlers' kids were piling off the back of the speeder, rifles in hand. Vika grinned at her father and shouted again,
Hail to the King!
Don't call me that,
Orin growled. He hated the name, and Vika knew better than to use it. But he heard it again from here and there in the swelling crowd.
All hail, King of the Jundland!
No, no, don't do that,
Orin said. He laughed, loudly enough so they could hear him. He knew not to take it seriously. These people weren't looking for a ruler. It was why half of them were on Tatooine. They needed to know he knew that too. Orin leaned the gadurfi against the hood of his landspeeder and raised his hands in humility. It's a team effort, he said, quieting the crowd. Always. You folks. You saved that farm. His voice rose. And never, ever forget why we're doing this. Remember the people that the Tuscans have killed for no reason at all. People who were just trying to make an honest living. Farmer after farmer, we've lost more prospecting knowledge than we can ever appreciate. It's why we all came together to set up the Settlers' Call years ago, to help us take back our lives. He pointed to a tall vaporator tower, rising from the slope to the south of the store. Up there on top is the very first siren, erected on Danar Calwell's old number one vaporator. Some of you new folks didn't know Danar, but he was the best friend a man and this oasis could have. The Tuscans took him from us, too. But the Siren remains one of many. That's part of his legacy to us. Danar's gone, but the call still goes out. And it's our job to answer it. Warren softened his voice. That's the key, folks. I know you're not fighters. I know you have your own field you should be working right now. And it's not always easy to find the extra credits that keep the settlers' call going. I've sure put plenty into it myself, and not just money. He choked up for a moment and paused to clear his throat. But that's just it. Many of you know my younger son died a few years ago, answering the call. He did it to save a neighbor. There's not a day that I don't miss him. But I don't regret at all what he went to do. A community's a living thing. And our actions together keep it alive. Warren looked up. The settlers were watching him spellbound, as usual. That's all, he said, breaking the solemnity. And before you drink up, a reminder. Any of you who haven't paid your subscription for the season, the Settlers' Call Fund office is in the back, behind the secondhand clothing. You might need us at your place one day. These speeders don't run on goodwill. Warren smiled as several of the posse members rushed to shake his hand. He glanced up at the climbing suns. His crews had lost most of the morning in the fields, but this was important too. Without camaraderie, there was no community. The oxygen that the settlers' call needed to function. Subscriptions always went up after a Tuscan attack, but that was nothing compared with what happened after a successful defense and retaliation. He nodded to Mullen, who opened the door to the store for the settlers. Anna Lean stormed through it, nearly knocking Mullen down. Warren spotted something long and black in her hands a second before she found her son in the crowd. Jabe, in the middle of being ribbed by Vika about something, looked back at Annalene, startled. Mom, A golden electric flash struck the ground not far from the teenager's feet. Startled, the boy jumped backward, tripping over his boots and landing on his rear. Mullen and Orin stood back.
Yikes,
Mullen said. Orin nodded. Yep. Jabe looked up from the sand to see his mother holding a bantha prod.
What the?
Realizing what had happened, his immediate reaction was incredulity.
You almost shocked me!
Oh, did I miss?
Annalene snarled. Maybe I should try again.
Mom!
Behind Orin, Callie appeared in the store doorway holding a shorter staff.
Mom, do you want to switch to the training prod?
This is training him just fine, Annalene growled. Taking a breath, she looked at the bantha prod for a moment before rolling her eyes and tossing it away. She turned and loomed over Jabe.
Now you listen to me. You did not have my permission to skip out on the breakfast prep. You did not have permission to go working in the suns with these roughnecks.
Her voice climbed.
And you sure as blazes don't have my permission to go out with the posse!
Jabe coughed, more embarrassed than hurt.
Mom, people were in danger. You were in danger.
Smirking, Orin gestured to the amused vigilantes who had forgotten about the free spirits.
A wide berth, gentle creatures, if you please. Annalene Caldwell is parenting again.
Hearing his voice, Annalene turned abruptly and sputtered.
And you!
Orin outweighed his best friend's widow by 30 kilos, and yet, as she started toward him, he took a step backward. Self-preservation came before public image. Spying the Gaderfi resting against the hood of his landspeeder, he playfully picked it up and held it with both hands, in simulated defense. But Annalene kept coming.
Easy there, he said.
She grabbed at the midsection of the Gaddurfi and used it to pull him toward her.
I'm telling you for the last time, Orin, if you ever let Jabe go out on one of your posses again, you better wrap your head in bandages and stay with the Tuskins. Now, Annie, don't you now Annie me, she cut in, livid. I mean it, Orin.
You can get your speeders out of my garages and park them under a tarp, she said, pushing at the gaffy stick. You want somebody to feed your crew? You go to Bestine. You want guns? You talk to Jabba.
Hey now, Orin said defensively, aware again of the rapt crowd. Even the drinkers had come out of the claim to watch. This isn't some eastern town. This is the Pico Oasis. Nobody here messes with Jabba.
You cross me again and you'll feel like a hut landed on you. Green eyes blazed at him.
Understood?
You get the wildest ideas. Now calm down, or you'll leave your boy an orphan.
With a heave, Orin tugged at the weapon. He expected resistance. But she let go suddenly, and his arm, overbalanced, swung the Gaddurfi in a wide arc, right into the windshield of his landspeeder. Shards flew everywhere. Orin eyed the mess.
Great, he said. Just great.
He looked back at Annalene.
See what you made me do? Me? You were holding it.
Annalene barely glanced at the shattered windshield. I hope you took a lot better care of my son out there.
Jabe takes care of himself just fine, Warren said, growing aggravated.
You're treating him like a droid with a restraining bolt.
Oh, really? Really?
He and Annalene were in each other's faces now. And maybe you should look at yourself, Orin said.
Ask yourself just why he feels the need to get out from under.
A husky voice came from the crowd.
Ah, just kiss her already.
Who said that?
Annalene's eyes darted around the spectators.
Who said that?
We all did,
Lily said, crossing her arms and shaking her head. Annalene snorted at her friend.
I thought you left.
What, and missed the entertainment?
The settlers to either side of the Zeltron laughed. While Annalene smoldered, Orin quickly passed the Tuscan weapon to his son. Half the Oasis had been trying to set Annalene up with Orin since his last wife left. The other half assumed they were already together. But Orin knew better than to react in the slightest. There wasn't a more dangerous subject in the galaxy. Annalene pivoted and returned to her son. Callie was helping him stand. He seemed flustered and a little tipsy to Orin, but undamaged.
Lily's right, Mom, the farmer heard Callie whisper.
You and Orin have been doing this dance for years.
You can be replaced,
Annalene told her daughter, ire returning.
Go do something.
Callie looked at her, offended.
Okay.
She turned on her heel and left, abandoning Jabe, who immediately fell back to the ground. As Annalene collected her son, Orin directed Mullen to take his landspeeder back to the garage.
It's no big deal. Just have Glomer put the repair on the account, he said,
remembering some of the debts he had coming due. Orin lowered his voice and added to Mullen, the store's account. The show over, the crowd filtered into the claim. Annalene brushed herself off. She would have a lot of people to serve. Orin chanced a conversation with her before he followed the others.
Did you get the bazaars put up?
Annalene expelled a deep breath.
They're in the guest quarters now. They came in just as I was heading out to meet Jabe.
Blessed reason.
I hope you at least put down the bantha prod, Orin said. Those people have been scared enough.
Orin watched as Annalene tried and failed to suppress a smile.
No, she said. They're okay. The doc's in with them.
That's good. Before he could enter the store, Annalene pulled at his sleeve and looked at him with concern.
They said it was Plug-Eye.
Oren spoke softly.
Yeah, they got old Lotho and the Bith farmhand, but we took out a few.
He paused. Our people didn't chase far. She stared keenly at him.
And Jay was never in danger? Everyone lives with danger here. You know that. But if you try to turn that boy into a clerk like his daddy, you're going to lose him altogether. You need to trust me.
Oren tapped her on the shoulder. Now, if both your children are accounted for, I think we've got about 30 heroes waiting for their drinks in there. On the funds tab, she said, with what he took for mock sternness. Then, she nearly smiled.
Yes, we'll be all right.
Oren grinned as he held the door open for her. This would turn out to be a good day after... A loud crack resonated from the other side of the building, followed by a feral yelp. A young woman's indecipherable yell came a second later.
Now what?
Puzzled, Oren rounded the building. There, in the side yard, he saw smashed corral fencing and a cloud of dust heading toward the dunes to the southwest. He could just make out the blonde figure amid the whirlwind, hanging on for dear life. Annalene appeared beside him. Tell me it isn't.
Can't lie to you,
Oren said, peering into the distance.
That would be your Callie, running off on a crazy dewback.
Snit!
Oren sighed and shrugged. Well, you did tell her to go do something.
Chapter 5.
Ayak jabbed the knife again into the warrior's arm. Black streamed from the cut, fouling the young Tuscan's wrappings. The shrapnel was buried deep, too deep for Ayak to reach. The survivors of the raiding party had been glad to reach the pillars, a jagged cleave into the Jundland, where the settlers and their vehicles could not follow. But the wastes had taken offense at being used for cowardice, and the young Tuscan had paid. The injured warrior had evaded the settlers' gunfire, but not the accursed grenade they had thrown before leaving, and what it had done to the rock wall. The arm would grow diseased, the hand unusable. If something happened beyond that, the Tuscans never knew. It wasn't a thing worth knowing. Ayak gave the blade to the warrior and spoke the words. They were the words known to all of them, the words that separated a Tuscan from the other creatures that lived in the dust.
Whoever has two hands can hold a Gaderfi.
The warrior stared at the weapon but did not question his duty. Another would take his bantha. The band could no longer afford to lose warrior and beast both. Ayak gave the warrior his solitude and made a mental note to send someone over for the body. The important work was with the others now. The morning's raid had been a risk, perhaps too great a risk when their numbers were so small. And yet, Ayak had been certain that it was necessary. The settlers had grown too bold. The Tuscans needed to be bolder. What remained of the clan now hid, like the coward sun among the pillars. Legend held that a giant had repeatedly struck the mountains with a dagger here. Some said it was the younger son himself, flailing against his brother. Whatever the explanation, the landscape was unreal. Natural stone columns and crumbling obelisks climbed to the sky, some topped by precariously perched boulders. A maze of narrow passageways crisscrossed among the towers. Some led to caverns, some led nowhere. A clearing amid the tall rocks provided enough room for a cramped campground around a sacred well. Banthas and sand people alike clumped in the craggy stomach of the Jundland. No one said anything as Ayak passed through the camp. The dozens who had remained here during the raid knew that many weaklings had fallen. There was no time to mourn the unworthiness of kin. Those names, those voices belonged to the past.
The sand people had to survive today.
The Tuscans had a word for tomorrow, but it was seldom used. What good would it be? Death rode behind the Tuscan as the shadows to the Bantha. The settlers seemed not to know that. Erecting shelters to protect their precious futures, the settlers became things fat and fleshy, no better than huts. Perhaps that was how the huts had come to be. A Yark had never really wondered about it, or much else. No, only today mattered. Each day's survival was a trophy that could be carried into the tales of the past. A stroke against the damnation cast upon them by the suns. It was a thing to be proud of. But who would tell the stories if all fell? At the well, the thirsty war leader dismissed the idle thoughts and pulled the rope. The noons were coming. Younglings needed feeding. Gaderfi Point sharpening. And a new target would need to be chosen. A Yark would select it, as always. The container reached the top of the well. For the third time in as many days, it held only damp sand. Others had called it an ill omen. A Yark simply wanted to kill something. A cloth-bound youngling ran up and bleated a message from the watch. A Yark listened with rising anger. There was someone riding an animal through the dunes. Again. There had been other encroachments near the wastes recently. A Yark had even heard of a single hooded human riding a heavily laden Eope across the desert from east to west, untouched by the Tuscan scouts who espied him. A Yark had flown into a rage over that one. A settler might take a machine across the dunes, or attempt to, but this was the act of one whose wits were lost. Or of a being so powerful, he felt none could harm him. A Yark didn't care what the answer was. Such impudence should have been dealt with, no matter what their current state. The others hearing the youngling took up their weapons right away. Good, a Yark thought. Even after this morning, some spirit remained. But much needed doing here. They would stay while a Yark went to investigate and punish the intruder. And if they argued the point, someone else would lose an arm. This kill would belong to a Yark.
Yah!
Annalene yanked again at the reins. Vilas heard and rumbled forward, nimbly crawling over the rocky outcrop. He was over it in a few seconds. Another call from Annalene and he was off again, barreling across the floor of the dusty Bowl Valley. Kicks from a rider meant nothing to the dewback, whose brownish-red scales could protect it against any spur. But Vila seemed to understand where he was going and what he had to do. It was why Annalene had headed directly for him when she'd seen the busted fence. Her landspeeder would have been faster, but Callie and Snit had lit off in the direction of the Rumbles, a lightly rocky stretch known mostly for the turbulent ride it gave hovercraft. That was no problem, but it also made for more difficult tracking at speed. Vilas, on the other hand, knew right where to go, she hoped.
That's the one, she said, picking out the right cloud from several dust devils in the distance.
Vilas knew it too. She clung to him. Annalene hadn't ridden in 3 years, but it wasn't something she was likely to forget. Half the dewbacks in Bastine today had descended from Caleb Thaney's herd. She'd be working on her father's ranch still if the animals hadn't gotten the parch, a wasting disease that prevented their cells from utilizing water. By the end, there had been little left of the herd, or of Caleb, who'd watched as all his farmhands left. After Annalene was forced to take a job working for Danar, her father became unreachable. 4 years later, after she and her mother relocated to a hut nearer the oasis, he finally took a blaster to his sorrows. Annalene had found him at home just 3 days after her announced engagement. He'd relocated the dozen remaining dewback eggs to what had once been her nursery years before.
The livery stables and corral of the claim had been Danar's surprise wedding present to Annalene. The Thaney legacy lived on outside her store window, providing her distraction and solace. And when Danar had died, Callie, then 9, had found that same peace in tending the creatures. Annalene had ceded all care of the animals to her then. Callie needed it. And there was something else. The girl wouldn't have to spend her teen years debating the price of blankets with people who couldn't remember her name. It felt good to be on a dewback again, though, even given the danger. Snit had been a temptation, a challenge sitting there for Callie for far too long. Annalene suspected now that Snit had mountain dewback blood in him. One of Orin's crews had brought a batch of eggs after digging them up in the field. Mountain dewbacks were just shy of the cannibal breed for craziness. Annalene cursed herself for not doing a proper genetic workup before. She knew how, and the stable had simple diagnostic tools. But she'd been too busy. And neither of her kids were proving much good against temptation. Callie was in sight now, half a kilometer ahead. Snit didn't show any signs of stopping. Annalene and her mount cut directly across the flats toward them. Callie was still out of earshot, but Annalene could see the girl was no longer in control of the beast, if she ever had been. The Calwell livery beat all others for safety. 3 mighty girth straps went around each dewback's midsection, securing saddles. But those only worked well if the dewback sat still for a fitting, and she couldn't imagine Snit had. The resultant loose straps, she now saw, had caused the saddle to start sliding off Snit's back to the right. Callie, her foot tangled in a stirrup, was hanging over the animal's side, desperately clinging to the reins. With every futile attempt to climb back atop Snit, the girl was driving him crazier. He wouldn't stop until he'd shaken her. Snit topped a rise and vanished. Annalene reached it long seconds later. What she saw on the other side took her breath away. She'd known the eastern reaches were prone to sinkholes, but this place was a geologic minefield. Worse, it was the kind of pockmarked landform favored by, and often caused by, creatures so horrific they nearly defied description. Sarlaccs. Big underground appetites that preyed on anything foolish enough to wander along. Monsters that could swallow a land speeder whole, but were often impossible to see until they had you. And Snit was running straight into the place. Annalene doubled up on the reins and pushed ahead. Vila snorted, straining against her. He didn't like the look of the area, she could tell, and she couldn't blame him. But she had to play the odds. Sarlaccs were rare. There was a particularly large one at Carcoon, another near some of Tatooine's many ancient ruins she'd heard tell. Even a tiny one of their spawn could be a fatal discovery. But there was no other choice now. She prodded the animal into a bounding run, keeping as far away from the mini craters as possible.
Help!
Annalene's eyes left the pitted ground and darted 100 meters ahead. Snit was going places fast, and Callie was still stuck.
Mom, help!
Annalene's heart caught in her throat, but she realized it meant that Callie had seen her. She gritted her teeth and pushed forward, her senses overloading. There was sand flying everywhere in Snit's wake. Annalene's hair, now unbound, blew openly and violently behind her. The desert floor rose and fell below, present here, absent there. And there was the constant thrum, thrum, thrum of Velas's feet slamming against the surface, reverberating through her body. Yet she was still gaining. Velas got his legs tangled up for a moment, but recovered quickly. Facing away from the chase for that second, Annalene thought she saw a Tusken raider peering at her from over a far distant dune. A moment later, she was back on track and sure she was hallucinating. Too much adrenaline. Snit, up ahead, didn't seem to care about anything. Annalene's voice cracked as she yelled into the wind.
Stop! Stop!
Snit was only a dozen meters ahead of her, and Annalene could see clearly how Callie was tangled in the stirrup. The terrified girl was half-sliding off Snit's right side now, and in imminent danger of shaking free and landing beneath the beast's massive rear legs. Annalene had to move.
Sorry, boy, she called to Vilas. Gotta do this!
She pushed the dewback harder, bringing him within nipping distance of Snit's left hind shank. There was no question of riding up on the right. Callie would be doubly in danger then if she fell. Annalene would have to bring the monster under control herself. Vilas moderated his pace, fearful, Annalene figured, of Snit turning on him. But she was close enough. She released the reins, threw her weight forward, and scrambled up onto Vilas's massive neck, the dewback scales skinning her gloveless hands. She looked down at the narrowing space between the two dewbacks. Grit exploded from the ground, each pounding step of Snit's a sandy geyser. If Snit knew Vilas was alongside, he hadn't reacted. Yet. But he surely would. What would he do then? Annalene had mounted a trotting dewback before, but never an angry one, running at full speed from atop another animal. Snit could do anything. It was too dangerous to try. But she could hear Callie, too, crying out with every bump. Now! Annalene reached into space, clutching for Snit's rearmost girth strap. It was the only part of the rigging that looked at all secure. And it was. The second she had a firm grasp on it, she heaved herself from Vilas to Snit. This Snit did notice, and he wasn't the least bit happy about it. He snapped his mighty tail forward, trying to swat away the woman hugging his back. Annalene hung on, pulling herself ahead, handhold by tenuous handhold. Vilas was gone now, having angled off to the north. Annalene was committed. Still clinging, she grabbed Callie's arm and tried to pull her up. No good. The load was too much, her hold too awkward. Annalene feared toppling them both off. But better they go on or go off the creature together. Annalene reached over to grab a handful of shirt and saw something off to the right. It appeared just at the edge of her peripheral vision. For a split second, she thought it was the imagined Tuscan. But jerking her head backward for a moment, she saw the reality was more unbelievable. Another rider had joined the chase, angling in from the faraway rise to the southeast. A figure clad in brown, racing at a diagonal to catch up with them. Running at full tilt on an EOP? Annalene looked down at Callie, whose face was frozen in terror, and then back at the newcomer. She'd seen it all right. An EOP. A fraction the size of the dewback, four-legged and tan. An EOP could sprint, but its legs were no match for those of the dewback. And yet the hooded figure guided it quickly along, with no more effort than one would exhibit driving a speeder bike. Annalene gawked. The rider couldn't possibly catch up to them, but he was certainly trying. Not all desert brigands were Tuscans, she knew, but a smart scavenger wouldn't chase anyone down in this terrain. He'd wait for the women to break their necks. Did this one actually want to help them? She wondered. He answered that himself.
Hold on!
The EOP nimbly danced along the edges of the sandpits, making no more imprint with its hooves than if it had been riderless. The man, close enough now that Annalene could make out a human nose and an auburn beard and mustache under the flapping hood, rode the creature expertly, approaching Snit without seeming regard for his own safety. Snit's tail whipped back and forth wildly, forcing the EOP rider to weave and dodge. But he continued to accelerate. A second later, he was alongside the deranged reptilian. Annalene looked ahead at the tortured terrain, worse than anything behind. Snit's massive hind feet might punch through the crusty sand and catch anywhere. When Annalene looked back, she could tell the mystery rider saw the danger too.
His eyes locked with hers.
Give me the girl! Without thinking, Annalene repositioned her arm under Callie's chest and pushed. Her daughter, unaware of the new arrival, screamed as she lost her last handhold on the reins. But less than a breath separated the Eope and the Dewback now, and a long arm reached from the billowing cloak to grab her. Annalene transferred Callie's other arm to his and shoved. Annalene slammed across the monster's back as the weight fell away. She saw Callie and the rider atop the Eope, which was slowing now from the additional burden. No way would it carry two for long, nor three for a second. Snit was her problem. Recovering, she looked forward. It was just a matter of finding the... Snit's rear foot struck a hole. Annalene went somersaulting forward, even as the impossible mass of the Dewback went aloft underneath her. She saw light as the suns flashed before her eyes, and then darkness as the bulk of the Dewback eclipsed them. And then, nothing.
Chapter 6.
Mom!
Annalene opened her eyes and swiftly shut them.
I can't see. Wait,
Callie said, brushing the grains of sand from her mother's eyelashes.
Try now.
Annalene tried again. She saw a young face stained by sandal grease hovering over her, lit from above by the high suns. Annalene tried to speak, but her voice cracked.
Callie, you...
You.
It's okay, Mom. I'm okay.
You're grounded, Annalene said.
For life.
Callie grinned.
She's going to be all right.
Yes,
replied someone else.
She is.
Annalene couldn't hear where the voice was coming from, but she didn't want to sit up to look either. Not when the sand was nice and soft and warm. Callie vanished from her view, and another face replaced hers. It was the rider from before. His hood was removed now. He had reddish-blonde hair, lighter than his beard and mustache. His blue-gray eyes looked on her with what Annalene interpreted as bemusement.
"Hello there," he said, in an accent she couldn't place. "You've taken a nasty spill."
"You might be on to something," Annalene said, coughing.
He smiled. Pleasant smile, she thought, not one of Orin's winning ones, to be sure, but understated and inflected with well-meaning, as was his voice.
"You're in one piece," he said. "You'll be picking sand out of your clothes for a while, but nothing appears broken."
The man produced a canteen from the folds of his cloak. It was an old garment, she saw, its deep brown turned tawny in places from wear. Beneath, she could see he wore a blousy tan tunic. The stranger paused as he knelt close.
"May I?"
Annalene tried to nod. He lifted her head gently so she could take a drink. Annalene drank desperately, half realizing that 17 years of her teachings about strangers in the desert were vanishing before her daughter's eyes. Annalene didn't know what to think about the newcomer, other than that he seemed to be dressed out of her seconds bin at the store. Annalene gasped as she finished swallowing. She nodded her thanks to the stranger and then narrowed her eyes.
"Callie."
The stranger stepped away and her daughter reappeared.
"Yes, Mom?"
Annalene's hand shot up, grabbing at the girl's collar.
"What were you doing?"
A guilty look crossed Callie's face.
"Well, you had half the galaxy showing up at the claim to get drunk, and before lunch even. I figured if I didn't get out and work the animals on the range, I'd be stuck in there helping."
"Yes, but why that animal?"
I don't know," Callie shrugged. "Besides, I didn't think you'd care. You were busy with Jabe, as always."
Behind the girl, the stranger fastened the lid in his canteen and chuckled.
If you were trying to get your mother's attention, my young friend, you succeeded.
He flashed that disarming smile again. Callie's brown eyes lit up, and she beamed at him.
Oh, please, you can call me Callie.
He smiled politely, and Annalene glared at her daughter.
Grounded for life, she said, and tried to sit up. A second later, she realized the futility of the attempt and surrendered to gravity. The stranger was back down in a flash, catching her.
His riding gloves exposed his bare fingers, and she could feel them in her hair.
Don't do anything rash, he said. We just got you back to the world.
Right. With the help of the two of them, Annalene sat up.
I was heading home from Bastien when I saw you were having troubles, he said. That was some masterful riding, you catching up to your daughter. I hope I didn't offend you by getting involved.
No, no offense, Annalene deadpanned. Turning her head, she saw what had become of Snit. The dewback drooled on the sand, his once crazed eyes staring mindlessly at her. Looking along the animal's length, Annalene thought his rear leg looked like a half-deflated balloon. The bones, deep inside, had shattered badly from the misstep. But more remarkable was where Snit was, only a couple of meters behind her. The creature had just missed her when he landed.
It was a lucky thing, the man said.
Lucky, Annalene said, rubbing the side of her head. There'd be a knot there for sure.
I was afraid we'd run into a sarlacc. A healthy fear to have.
Annalene forced herself to stand. Once sure of her bearing, she wiped her hand on her shirt and presented it.
Annalene Calwell. Annalene.
The man seemed reluctant at first to shake her hand, but soon did so amiably.
I haven't heard that one. Family name?
Not any longer, if I have anything to say about it, she said, smiling. Most just call me Annie. The rescuer paused, and for a moment she thought she saw his eyes fix, as if looking somewhere else. But the gentle smile quickly returned.
No, Annalene is just fine.
And you've met the tornado? Annalene said.
Callie,
the girl repeated, going for a handshake of her own. The man nodded.
Ben.
Before Annalene could ask more, he stepped past her to examine Snit. The animal seemed catatonic.
I don't know much about this species, he said, but he doesn't look good.
He's in shock.
Ben appeared concerned. Can he make a go of it on three legs?
Let me ask the livery manager. Annalene looked over at Callie, who was adjusting the saddle on Vilas. What do you think? Her daughter splayed her arms and whined.
I didn't mean for this to happen.
Callie hated to lose any creatures at all. But even if Snit could somehow go on, Annalene had half a mind to shoot the nasty thing anyway. Which was when Annalene realized she had no weapon at all out here on the desert with a vagrant. But as before, Ben somehow seemed to sense her unease. He whistled once, and his Eyopi scampered back toward him. The animal was spry, despite being heavily laden with gear. Callie smiled.
What's her name?
Rue. Well, that's what they told me when I bought her.
Ben patted the Eyopi's snout.
Good job, Rue,
he said reassuringly. It reassured Annalene anyway. One thing about the lowlifes of Tatooine, they were seldom nice to children and animals. Ben had saved her child from an animal. And with that, her judgment was made.
Well, good job to you too, Ben, she said, dusting herself off. Why were you coming this way again?
Scratching the Eyopi's neck, he nodded to the southwest.
I've set up house near the wastes. Just running some errands. Things to do, you know.
Annalene brightened. No need to go to Bastien. She looked at some of the gear jutting from Rue's saddlebags.
You're closer to the oasis. The Pika Oasis.
He scratched his beard.
I heard there was a shop there.
Danar's claim. Best store in the Oasis. Only store in the Oasis.
Callie piped in from behind. Annalene spoke without looking over her shoulder.
Girl, I hope you're not talking again, because if you are, you should be apologizing to me and to this man, and to the dewback you nearly killed.
Ben chuckled and then stifled it. Annalene calculated he had kids of his own, or that he'd at least worked with them. He looked down at the Yopi's load.
This store, it has vaporator pots.
Wouldn't be much of a store without. And besides, you're looking at the... Before Annalene could continue, Ben's expression changed. Suddenly alert, he held up his hand.
Wait,
he said, turning. All three fixed their eyes on Snit's motionless body and watched as it began to descend, sinking in the sand. A groan came from beneath, and a tremor rocked the place they were standing.
I'm afraid that's your Sarlacc,
Ben said. Tendrils snaked upward, lashing around the huge form of the dewback. Annalene saw Ben reach for an object beneath his cloak, only to stop when he noticed her watching. She waved him off.
There's no blasting at a Sarlacc, she said. Perhaps you're right.
The tentacles began straining at the dewback, pulling it downward. Ben grabbed at the lead on a startled Yopi. Annalene hustled her daughter toward Vilas. Callie looked back in anguish.
Snit!
Comes out of your earnings, Annalene said, shoving the girl onto Vilas's saddle. She climbed in front. And you hang on this time. From atop Rue, Ben paused to look in amazement at the disappearing beast. The appetite of a Sarlacc was something no traveler could see and forget, Annalene knew. She wanted to ask where he was from, but it clearly wasn't the time.
Thanks again. Maybe we'll see you in the Oasis.
Ben smiled mildly and nodded.
Maybe.
He pulled his cowl back over his head.
See you soon, Ben!
Callie yelled, waving. Annalene rolled her eyes. So much for remorse over Snit. Beneath them, Vilas started walking, eager to get away from the new Sarlacc pit. Remembering something, Annalene looked back at Ben, poised to head off to the southwest.
Hey!
Yes.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't catch your last name.
Oh, he said, only to tilt backward as Rue broke into a sudden trot.
Sorry,
he said with an apologetic wave as the Yopi ran.
I think she wants to get home.
No doubt,
Annalene thought. She's not alone. From behind a dune, a Yark watched the trio part company. The warrior's one good eye was very good indeed, and the lens in the eyepiece could see far when adjusted. Whoever had crafted it had done a useful thing with his or her existence. But a Yark now doubted the work because the eyepiece had seen something that made no sense at all. Just after the Yopi riding male had plucked the young female from the racing dewback, an impressive feat to be certain, the out-of-control creature had tripped in a hole and flipped over, throwing the woman who was riding it. She should have been crushed by the dewback, but instead of falling on her, the beast had been caught by the air itself and actually hovered there, bobbing for a second. It was as if the world itself had rejected the mad thing. Then it tumbled once in midair and fell away at an angle, coming to rest just shy of the woman's body. The younger woman, partly hanging over the Yopi saddle in the wrong direction, had not seen it. But the male rider had seen it happen, and was unfazed by it. Surprise was the one human expression all Tuscans learned to recognize. This man had not displayed any at all, not even when a giant dewback floated on air. The Tuscans were well aware of the powers the settlers had at their disposal.
They used lesser magics, their spells all relying upon physical components linked together in a certain way. A landspeeder was a conglomeration of trinkets. If the ordering of the pieces was in any way disturbed, it lost its powers. An unreliable magic, to be sure. But there was no metal, no unnatural material, no mechanism present here. Just humans. That was when a Yark had slipped back behind the dune to think. This was no false dragon call. What did it portend? Things were already bad for the Sand People. If the settlers had now added to their capabilities, then caution was demanded. A Yark needed to know what the Sand People were facing. What was this power? And which one of the humans had it? As far as a Yark was concerned, there was no reason for the human male to put himself at risk for either of the women. What had brought them onto the desert floor was apparent. The women had obviously tried, as so many settlers had, to tame the very spirit of life on Tatooine, in this case, the Dewbacks who belonged in the mountains. It was right that they had failed. They should have died, and the hairy-faced male should have let them. Living beings helped only themselves. That was the Tusken way. And it suggested that the woman had the sorcery in her to land so gently and to brush the Dewback aside. The man must have known she was in no danger, that she had the power to save herself. Yes, that made sense. While the woman recovered from her feet, a Yark had sat, contemplating the right path. The conclusion was now clear. The settler woman had to be killed, and quickly, before she taught her skill to another. Now, while her Dewback carried two, a Yark felt another tremor in the sand. It was gentle and would have gone unnoticed by another. A Yark knew it for what it was. The accursed Sarlacc had many children in locations unknown to the Tuskens. Most sat inert, starving, never becoming. But the feast of the Dewback by one had awakened others. This was no time to find out how many more existed. No, the information a Yark had just learned needed to reach the clan. The humans could be found again without difficulty. Then the Tuskens would all move as one, knowing they were doing a truly important thing. It would be the victory they needed to regain their defiant spirit once and for all. A Yark left the hiding spot and departed for the hills, not as the cowardly son, but as the hunter. It felt good. Meditation. Let's try this again. I'm afraid I haven't had any success with this means of communication, Master Qui-Gon. Perhaps you haven't had anything to say? That's fine. I've tried speaking to you mentally. I'll try speaking aloud for a while and see if that makes a difference. Since I last tried speaking to you, I've made some tactical moves. Owen Lars didn't want me hanging around near his home anymore. He had a point, believe it or not. Creeping on hillsides every morning and every night might not be the best way to avoid drawing attention to his farm. So I've found another place. You might be alarmed when you hear how far away it is. It certainly unnerves me. You remember the Zelric Draw, where we landed the ship from Naboo years ago? This is due south of that, up against the northern wall of the highlands, the Jundland Wastes. Only we're at the far end of the formation from where Owen lives, maybe 100 kilometers. It's a funny way to keep watch over someone, I know. I can't get there and back in a day en route, and I'm reluctant to get so much as a speeder bike for fear of the attention I'd attract. The Tusken natives seem to follow anything shiny they find. I could lead them to the last farm if I'm not careful, and anyone watching from satellite might notice a pattern to my travels. I've also ruled out leaving surveillance equipment.
Access to the galactic mainframe is spotty everywhere here, but regardless, I don't want to own anything that taps into it. I haven't even used the secret one-way message drop Bail Organa provided to tell him I've settled in. The fewer signals coming from my home, the better. What if Palpatine has eyes all the way out here, looking for Jedi Knights he failed to kill? It could happen. The other Jedi. How I hope others have survived. I couldn't bear to be the only one left. It seems impossible to imagine. I wish you could tell me. In any case, with regard to the Lars farm, it's probably okay if I just go over there once in a while on foot or en route. I can hide better that way and camp if I need. There won't be a pattern to my movements or when I choose to go. I won't be able to respond quickly if someone troubles the boy or even know about it, but at least I won't be the trouble. Still, I wish there was someone I could rely on, closer to them. I've been hearing some sirens to the north. There was another this morning. I worried it involved the Empire, but I think now it might be a warning system of some kind. Maybe that could be of help. I don't... This would be easier if you said something. Never mind, I'll be briefer. This house. It's in worse shape than I thought. I rode into Bastine to make sure it was unoccupied, but I hardly needed confirmation. The Jawas picked the place over long ago. There's a shell of a vaporator. If I can ever get it working right, it needs parts still. And the place should have a low profile if I can remove the trash from the yard. You can imagine what kind of junk even a Jawa would pass up. I was worried it was going to require more trips to Bastine. That's 40 kilometers or so. But maybe there's another option. Annalene. That's Annalene Calwell, a woman from the Pico Oasis, and her daughter. The Oasis is close, and from what she says, it has more of what I need to set up housekeeping here. Meeting her gave me a chance to finally use the name I chose. You'll like this. Ben. I had seen it on the map at the property office in Bastine. There's some mesa by that name. Steen used to call me that. It was a private thing. I like the sound of it. I'm afraid I drew some attention to myself when I met Annalene. I won't get into details, but she was in trouble, and I helped her. It felt good to be doing something after all this hiding, and good to be talking to someone again when I'm feeling so alone and... Ah, well... I don't know. I'm closer to the Oasis, but it's closer to me, too. Maybe it's not a good idea to become too familiar a sight with the locals. I probably won't go.
Chapter 7.
How it look, Master Gold?
Real pretty, Glomer. Orin ran his hand across the new windshield on the landspeeder. Like new? I don't know how you do it. Orin wasn't surprised. Of all the mechanics in the Cowell garages, Glomer, a green-skinned Findian whose dangly arm nearly reached his ankles, was by far the best. Starting from a single rented Bay 5 years earlier, Glomer now ran a vibrant trade, taking up a building and a half. That made him the garage's third-largest occupant, after the Galt Vaporator installation fleet and the storage space for the Settlers Fund vehicles. Since Glomer worked on all of those, too, he and his assistants were seen almost everywhere.
"He's best speeder in Oasis,"
the mechanic said, his golden eyes alight in their white cavities.
"He's Marvel,"
Orin grinned. Findians could never let go of a vowel, it seemed. And few beings he had met had more appreciation for a fine vehicle. On this one, Glomer was right. The USV-5 looked as if it belonged on a nicer planet. Orin had dithered over buying it. A farmer shouldn't put on airs. But selling water was as much a part of the job as finding it. And the high-volume city accounts didn't want to buy from someone who'd looked like he worked for a living. Well, that was fine.
He could play that game. Glomer's lead assistant skittered past, carrying part of a metal airfoil. Something called a Vouvrian. The assistant was easily the most macabre thing in the garage, to Orin's thinking. Bipedal, but with an insect's head, and apparently a talent for thruster control systems. Orin didn't have a problem with non-humans. Compared with his parochial grandfather, his opinions were cosmopolitan. Any being willing to put its back into hard work was fine with him. Diligence knew no species, and neither did sloth. There were more than enough human bums around the Anchorhead Cantina to give his own kind a bad name. But Pappy Galt had been right on one thing. Business success was about taking the other's measure. Between any two people, a point existed where what one wanted intersected with what the other had. That point was price. And to get the best possible one, high or low, you had to see things the other person's way. But who knew what a Vouvrian or Bith was really thinking? You can't look a fellow in the eye when he's all eye. Orin had left Tatooine once, as a teenager. His grandfather had dispatched the hands to Rodia to fetch a vaporator. Even a second-hand device from one of the more technologically advanced planets was far better than anything most Tatooine farmers had in their fields. Left at home, Danar had joked that Orin would never be heard from again once he'd seen the stars. But if anything, Orin's brief sojourn told him Tatooine was the real home of opportunity. The galaxy was full of hustlers, all scratching for a credit. And Rodia, a humid place where people clustered under domes, jammed them together in one place like the jar he used to trap sandflies in. Keep them in there long enough, and they'd eat one another. No, Tatooine was much better. Mos Eisley might seem like a menagerie, but you could at least drive away. Tatooine had land, and Orin had his share. Thanking Glomer, he walked along the bays and looked back at his repulsor trucks in the garage. Too many were in the shop, as usual. Three more this morning. It was due not to any fault in Glomer's work, but to the boneheads that operated them. Orin's ostensible reason for going into the fields each day was to fine-tune the vaporators for better performance. But in fact, most of that time was spent checking up on his remote teams, who confounded him daily by inventing new ways to damage his machinery, his vehicles, or themselves. They were far behind in getting the fields ready for the harvest, and expenses had soared. He'd hoped the next generation would take some pressure off him. But Mullen and Vika had both somehow managed to reach their 20s without really growing up. Mullen's talent seemed to be ticking people off, not leading them. And Vika was, well, Vika. Jabe Calwell, though, had some of his late father's industry about him. Orin saw him playing a big role in things, if his mother would let him. But Orin would have to wear down Annalene first. Can't have a foreman whose mama won't let him work. Things had been quiet on the Tusken front in the days since the Bizarre incident. It would be a while before Plug-Eye would get up the nerve or the warriors to try another Dawn raid. But hostilities were still continuing between mother and son, Orin heard, as he opened the door into the sales floor of the claim.
"It's not fair, Mom!"
The voice was male, young, newly deep, and indignant.
"It's not fair, and you know it!"
"Fair," Annalene replied. "What's fair got to do with the price of water?" Jabe was on his knees and surrounded by multi-kilo pouches, a puzzle that in no way seemed likely to fit together on the shelves. He was not happy to be there.
"Why don't you get Callie to do this?"
Annalene looked sternly down the aisle from her counter. "Callie has her own job and you know it.
This stuff's feed. Animals are her department."
"That's outside the store. This is inside the store."
You want me to play back a recording from the last 10 times we've had this conversation?
Annalene spotted Oren's approach.
You better not be here for a piece of this.
Oren plucked his good cape from the rack by the door and smirked.
No, Annie. I know when I'm beat.
He looked down at Jabe.
Sorry, kid. Maybe next career.
Seeing Jabe's shoulders droop, Oren winked to reassure him. The boy had to know he had an advocate in him. It was just a matter of time.
Oren tied the cape around his neck as he made his way around the castle of feed sacks.
How's Callie today?
Annalene rolled her eyes.
You'll have to ask her when she lands. She pointed down the counter to the luncheonette. There, Callie, recovered from her ordeal several days earlier, was in the midst of retelling the story of her rescue, this time to some teenage friends in from the fields.
And he just appeared, like he rode down out of the sky. And there were sarlaccs everywhere, but he plowed straight through to try to catch up with me.
Oren had heard this one twice in the past 2 days. He raised an eyebrow to Annalene.
Sarlaccs everywhere?
Today, yes. Annalene looked up from scrubbing the counter.
Wait a while.
She's added a giant cliff.
I'm not hearing her mention your role in things, Oren said.
Oh, I wasn't there.
Annalene said, a wry twist to her mouth.
I haven't been in the story for a long time.
Of course, I'm a great writer, and I could have handled it. But Ben's the type of guy who can't look the other way when he sees a woman in trouble. And he knew he had to save me from certain...
When do I meet this deity?
Oren said.
No idea.
Annalene scraped at a stain with frustration.
You know these drifters out in the wastes. He's probably gotten lost and eaten his Eopi by now.
Oren chuckled. This response was pure, Annie, but he could tell she was disappointed their rescuer hadn't paid a call. Oren was glad she'd found help out there. Since she'd left without her communicator, they would have had no way to find her. But the man's absence was probably just as well. Kindly nomads had a way of moving in once they knew you owed them something. The talk had spread to another table, he heard, as Lily and the older locals tried to identify the Ben in question.
There's that Ben Gadink, who sells the sand sculptures out of the back of his repulsor truck,
Lily said.
You're thinking Ben Moordriver, corrected Doc Mel. Ben Gadink runs the apothecary in Bastine.
Maybe Ben Crissel, the card cheat,
a young farmer said.
Ben Syrup, proclaimed an old one.
No, wait, he's an Ithorian.
In under 2 minutes, they had expanded the list of local Bens to double digits and completely exhausted Oren's interest. He stepped to the counter and found his lunchbox and fresh canteen in their usual place. Annalene noticed his cape.
Going somewhere?
Subscription drive again.
Again? I thought the Settlers' Fund met the annual goal weeks ago.
Well, safety's something you can never have enough of, he said. And the response to the Bizarre Raid shows the call's working as it's supposed to.
Annalene lowered her voice, not counting a couple of dead people.
The Bizarre husband had moved back home, but Tyla and the baby were still in her guest quarters.
I can't believe there's anyone left around here to sign up.
You know the main holdouts, he said. But I think we can start offering protection to farms a little farther away.
They'll be able to disband the militia in Mos Eisley before you know it,
Annalene said, stepping out from behind the counter with an armload of batteries.
Good luck, champ.
Oren clicked his tongue happily and turned toward the door to the garage.